You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Most people don't fail because of a lack of skill. They fail because they can't handle the pressure. In this episode, I sit down with mental performance coach Sabrina Shapiro to break down why high-level performers choke, how to stay consistent when motivation disappears, and what it takes to be a high performer at a high level without burning out. How'd you get into fencing? I mean, that's not a very conventional thing. Like, I think I maybe have met one or two people that fenced, and actually they were all from Europe. So to have an American that's in fencing is kind of unique. How did you get there?
Yeah, it's very big in Europe. I got into fencing kind of accidentally. I was always an athletic kid. I liked sports that involved sticks, like hockey, but they didn't have that near where I lived. And I really loved ballet. And ballet starts to get a little toxic once you get into your teens. And at that time, my ballet place was in a community center, and they moved to redo the floors. And I'm sure my mother was thrilled, but she was like, it's too far for me to take you to the substitute location. And they had fencing in the same community center. And I always liked sports. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll just try fencing. And the moment I started, it was a hit. It was definitely, my dance background actually helped a lot. So I think and I'm a lefty. So I think I had some natural ability in it too. And yeah, it stuck.
What's challenging about fencing? I mean, obviously the idea, it's extremely dynamic in nature, and you know, there's a lot of accuracy involved. Sorry. I don't know if you've ever been to Texas, but this time of year we have cedar, and like the cedar pollen hits everything. And like yesterday I was outside and I came in and I was like covered head to toe in all this yellow pollen. And like 3:30 last night I woke up and I was like, oh shit, like something, I got hit with something. In 2020 during COVID, same thing happened. And I was like, oh my God, this COVID thing's legit. And I went, I got tested. I came back negative for everything. And the doctor's like, no, you have cedar fever. And I was like, oh my God, this is a terrible thing. So yeah, this time in Texas. So my voice gets a little fucked up, just bear with me. But yeah, the technical aspect of fencing, you know, I mean, I can understand if you like sticks and you like ballet, it kind of fits in because it does look a lot like a dance.
Yeah, it's actually, in terms of strategy and the game, it's most similar to boxing. So as a coach, even now, it's like, I love when boxers and dancers want to become fencers because it's fun. The boxers really understand the game and they're very offensive, and I love to see it. But for myself, I love fencing because each person you go up against, it's a new puzzle. You know, they call it physical chess. I know jujitsu kind of also likes to go by that. And when I was a teenager, I was embarrassed by that name, physical chess, because I was like, we're not all dorks, you know, even though I like chess. So I don't know why. I like chess too. Yeah. So, but now I embrace it because both chess and fencing are pretty awesome.
Yeah. I do jiu-jitsu, and it's like solving puzzles. Each person brings a unique puzzle. Everybody has a unique strength. So it's very good. I call it athletic problem solving, that you're putting yourself in a position. You have to solve these equations in real time. And it's something that I've observed, I think, which is different than I grew up, than I see with my kids, even where we played outside, you know, and there was all this athletic problem solving. Like, how do I get off this fence to get up this tree? How do I get trying to figure out all these different puzzles. And then I realized that my kids don't solve puzzles the same way because they're not necessarily forced to. Now they solve puzzles, let's say, on their phone and video games or whatever else they do, which is not, I don't think, as useful, but in this world we live in is a, you know, we no longer live in an analog world. So it's a little bit different. But then how did you like transition from, you know, fencing and coaching? Was it something where you saw a massive gap that you realized you needed to fill with a lot of the mental coaching that you're doing?
Yes, there were a couple different gaps. One was that I struggled to find a club that I could allow. I'm happy to add my coaching flair to anywhere, but I noticed just in coaching that fencers were struggling to fit the mold, and they were all being coached the same way. And that I kind of mentioned already. So that was just one of the gaps. And there's a lot of performance anxiety, a lot of shouting in individual sports, especially. There's a lot of like jeering and cheering against you. And it feels personal. Your opponent literally beats you up. That's how you lose. So it feels, and people cheer when you get hit. So I think there's an added level of anxiety or focus that's needed and added in those situations. And the other thing was, I noticed that, especially also working outside of fencing in other combat sports, I noticed that the top athletes were not struggling necessarily with their performance at all. They were struggling in their life. Like, and they were either resistant to therapy or they did go to therapy and it wasn't working for them because they have an athlete mind and they really needed a performance coach, someone that could take all their performance skills and apply it to the rest of their life, because their lives were getting pretty chaotic unless they were at training and competing.
Is that a result of athletes not being, what's the right word, how do I put this? This is something I've observed as a professional athlete. A lot of times as a high-level athlete, especially from a young age, there's a lot of concessions made. There's a lot of like excuses. Well, they're a really good athlete. Like they don't have to study as hard, or we have to help them because they're good athletes. And so the problem is, if you're a good athlete from a young age, a lot of doors open and you're never really forced to struggle. Especially I went to Berkeley and they were, trying to put you into, these are easier classes. We have other student, mentors in these classes that can help you. And they did a lot to kind of help people along, because they needed to keep you in school. So for me, I didn't need that and didn't want that and wanted to be able to, feel the stress and be able to, compete on this level, just like I did on the football field. So I think because people are gifted from a young age, there's just certain concessions and they become kind of lazy in a lot of ways and they became almost one focused. And as a result, I think it doesn't force athletes to develop as a complete person. This episode of Power at the Radio is brought to you by the Business of Strength, the team behind Varsity House Gym. If you're a gym owner or a coach ready to build a career in fitness, check out their Strongest Year Project Mastermind. It's a 12-month roadmap with coaching, systems, and support from a team that's built multi-7-figure gyms. They're hosting Trainer School on January 23rd at Varsity House HQ in New Jersey. It's a one-day hands-on workshop to level up your coaching skills fast. Get a free strategy call and $1,000 off the Mastermind at businessofstrength.com/attend. Build a better business. Build your strongest year. We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to Field Strong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/fieldstrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show.
I think some of that is accurate. I remember seeing that in the NCAA with the basketball team. I would study with them and some of them could barely read and it wasn't their fault. They were being passed through all of their classes. It's like most of these guys are not going to the NBA, no matter how good they are here. And it was just sad to me. But I don't think that's the full picture. I think some of it is not laziness at all. It's that, they shine when the pressure is on, and when it's not, they're not sure exactly how to handle it. There's a lot of motivation dips and a lot of, life is chaotic. And once you find the thing that you're really good at, you work really hard in it. So they're not lazy at all. It's kind of a, there's people that excel in just normal everyday life. And those people are not normally the ones that also excel under pressure. And there seems to be, you know, our society isn't built for people who just are, you know, athletes, you know.
So with, in terms of challenging some misconceptions, like when people think of performance, it's either just a skill or an effort. Like, what's missing in that equation? And like, what's kind of missing the piece? I mean, it's so easy. I mean, there's a, I mean, I can't swing a dead cat without hearing somebody talk about physical performance in terms of this and this and this. I mean, it's everywhere. And then there's this whole kind of like gray matter cloud of like performance coaches that are mental performance coaches. And like, they're never very transparent about what they do or what the outcome is. They just have this kind of black box and we're going to do some stuff. And it's this kind of in between of like coaching and counseling and helping people with confidence. Like help kind of break this apart a little bit and help us see on the inside. And more importantly, like, where's the value for this?
So that's a great question. Peak performance involves not just optimal physical preparation. It involves optimal focus. It involves optimal motivation, optimal stress management. Like, there are so many components. You'll have someone who's very confident, but overly critical of themselves, and it's literally eating away at them. And so eventually their performance hits a wall. They can't go any higher because they're holding themselves back and they don't realize it. So a good performance coach will also explain why something needs to change, but how it can change. And I think that's what's missing. There's a lot of like why someone might need to do something, or they'll explain a piece of it. Like, we're doing this now. They might explain why, but they don't explain exactly how someone can build it for themselves. So I think it's very, very important when you're choosing a mental performance coach that they recognize that there are many ways to get to that optimal level and that each person has their own path to it.
So what issues allow, I mean, athletes tend to be terrible at asking for help. You know, yes. And I know I'm terrible at asking for help. So like, how does this thing kind of matriculate? Like, you know, like at which point does, you know, because if you're a high level athlete and everything's going well on the field or on the court or on the mat or, you know, wherever, like you tend to sweep all the other stuff under and be like, well, at least I'm kicking ass in this arena. Like, my life might be in shambles, but I'm really good at my job. So I'm just going to focus on that. Is it, you know, let's say like a team captain, a coach or somebody that's like, hey, we got to deal with this? Or is it something where they just get to the point where they're like, man, I need to talk to somebody. I need to somehow fight my way through this.
If they have a good coach, someone who, you know, not all coaches are aware that this is something available to their athletes. But if they have a coach that's aware of it, sometimes the coach will say, hey, listen, you need to get your head right, or you need to get your life together. Occasionally, an athlete will find it for themselves and come looking for me. But unfortunately, the unfortunate truth is a lot of them don't get the help they need, and it does impact their career. And I see this all the time. I work with a fighting gym in Vegas. I'm purposely being vague about it just for privacy. But I work with one of the big UFC feeder gyms, and those guys are chaotic, some of them. And they're used to that chaos, and they don't realize how badly it's impacting them. And dragging them in to sessions is very difficult, getting them to get like, and it does impact their performance. Sometimes they're like, oh, I got in another car accident. I had to move. These are brilliant fighters, but they're sure. Like, I had to move again. Sorry, I was late to our appointment. It's like, you had to move again. Like, what is going on in your life that is causing this? Let's look at it. Let's see how we can get your nervous system regulated so that you can actually perform it at a level that you can't even conceive of right now.
I mean, And this is something that I observed in having worked with professional athletes, both, you know, as a professional athlete and also worked, is like I said, like because they are very talented at what they do, there's a lot of concessions made where, you know, they become almost incomplete humans. And I used to see this all the time. Guys I played with, you would have conversations and listen to them and be like, shit, man, you should probably go talk to somebody. This sounds fucking terrible. Like, how did you get yourself into this mess? And I just wonder if for so long people didn't force them to either take responsibility, or they just were good at what they did so they didn't have to develop. Or maybe you only have so much emotional capacity, and when you're porting it over trying to be the best in the world, like something else kind of falls by the wayside.
I think that's a very excellent point. Yes. The emotional capacity is real. Like, there's only so much you can do. And there's only so much you're already getting help in all different areas of your training. Something's got to give. I think that sometimes with these fighters, it's not that people haven't challenged them, especially in combat sports. I'm not sure in football, but there's a lot of trauma in their past. It's not even that people went easy on them. It's that they never learned that there is a way to do this. They never learned, because they didn't have either, you know, there was abuse in their past or there was neglect, and they just had to fend for themselves for so long. They didn't realize that they could get help.
So is that a big piece, like kind of working through maybe traumatic childhood or some of the earlier things, and maybe the, developing confidence in like a greater arena rather than just, you know, in the cage or on the mat?
I think a big thing, well, for me, because I'm a performance coach, they're comfortable talking to me because we keep it in the realm of sports. We do go into it a little bit, but I often help them if they have that past. I kind of am also the liaison to get them some help for their trauma as well from a counselor. And we stay with the performance. And that's comfortable for them. And they trust me to allow them to help get them some extra help, which I'm very honored that that's part of my role.
So one of the things I observed, and I've seen this as a, you know, as an NFL player and also working with other professional athletes, and something I talk to my young guys, jiu-jitsu guys about often, is the idea that your best performance has to come on game day. And being able to realize that just practice is about sharpening the blade, getting better, and like what happens in practice isn't necessarily a representation of like what's going to happen on game day. And some of the best guys in the world were just kind of average practice players and yet went out and find an extra gear and were incredible game players. And I played with some guys that were incredible practice players and yet never had that extra gear. And so one of my young guys is actually fighting on Tuesday, the 31st of March. And you know, we had him on the podcast and we're kind of going through a little bit of this, what was impactful, what was helpful. And actually that statement, when he asked me about, you know, what was the difference that I observed, why some guys get to the NFL and don't actually end up having long careers. And I was like, the guys that have long careers are able to reach another level on game day and play at such a high level that isn't something that they could do necessarily in practice. Like the best practice I played, could never touch what I was able to do in the games. But yet I played with some guys that were incredible in practice that sucked in games. And so I always wondered if it had to do more with pressure or certain people react better. I just was never able to really crack that equation, or the fact that maybe they worried too much about what happened in practice. And when they got to the game, they didn't have like maybe the emotional capacity or the understanding, or given too much too early. Do you have any thoughts on that, or help me kind of crack that code a little bit?
Sure. Well, I do agree that there are some people that are just meant for the limelight when it comes to, like, they're meant to shine as soon as the pressure's on. And some people, they are really practice players. And sometimes the sad truth is that, as you said, those people don't make it very long under the limelight. And some people are truly just having one little hang up. And it could be in, there are many different areas in mental performance that one little hang up can happen and we can fix it. So it could be in the way that they're talking to themselves. Like it could be a self-talk issue. It could be that they're at the wrong arousal level. Like they're too hyped when they start, they come out too hyped or too relaxed and they just haven't found their optimal arousal level. Sometimes it's a focus thing or they're overthinking. And these are all issues that can be worked on. Or they have a control thing where there's just not enough controllables for them when the performance is happening. So all of these things can be worked on.
So where do you start with athletes? Let's say you have a young guy come in and, you know, he wants to increase his performance and, you know, where does that start? Does it come with goal setting and mindset or just some simple conversations to see about what some of his fears and phobias are?
Both, actually. The first session is often an assessment, but we also do some goal setting because then I can see how they define success, where they're actually wanting to get to. And that's also very telling for me on the type of athlete I'm dealing with. And it also helps them clarify their goals. So we've actually done something, even in that first session, we start right off with mindset.
With mindset. Well, let's do a session. Hit me with some questions. Give me a question. What do you got? I'm curious to know, like, how, you know, I mean, I know you have a ton of courses and stuff. I'd love to get in and discuss that. But, you know, that first deal where you're working about mindset and trying to figure out who you're working with, like, how does that initial thing happen? Because as an NFL player, I didn't have really that access to that. I think I talked to one of our team docs had been a psychiatrist in the Army. And his claim to fame was he developed the playlist that they used to blast out Noriega out of his house.
My God.
So he was well steeped in mental warfare. And I loved to talk to him because he had the best stories and he would ask me all these questions. And he was always kind of fascinated with a little bit of my mindset stuff because I always had this feeling that like it's always calmest right before the storm. And so I was never nervous about guys that were screaming and yelling. It's like you walk into a bar and the guys that are making the most noise, you don't worry about those dudes. You worry about the people that are real quiet. Like it's always the quiet ones that are the ones that wreck shop. And same in the NFL, because guys come in, beat their chest, want to like drag everybody into the shower and give all these fucking motivational speeches. And then you look over and there's like one dude just laying on the ground sleeping. Like that shit scared me. And I played with a guy like named Will Shields, played 13 years, went to 13 Pro Bowls in the Hall of Fame. And I looked over and he was sleeping before games. And like, I wake him up and be like, okay, let's go out and do it. And literally just like his heart rate never got up and just went out and owned people. And I always came down to this idea of like, you know, it's always calmest before the storm, cold as ice, just trying to be very, very calculating in what I did. And realizing that like big ups and big downs are way too much emotional energy, that if you're going to be able to play for a long period of time, you had to be very, very consistent. The problem is when you're focusing your whole life on being emotionally consistent, you almost have to like numb yourself a little bit to where now, like when you get out away from the field, you're in like emotional situations, whether they're a significant other or spouse or something happens, and you're just kind of even. And I dated girls that were like, I cannot read you. Like you have no emotion in anything. And it was kind of a very interesting thing. And it wasn't until I retired and I ended up getting married and having kids and like, you know, realizing that like that isn't very beneficial to kids if your dad is just fucking like this all the time. You know, they need to see happiness and joy and all that. So realizing what allowed me to play for a decade in the NFL probably wasn't the best approach for everyday life and being able to try to like observe that. And this podcast has been great. I mean, I've been able to do this for a number of years and talk to experts like you, which has helped me kind of develop my genealogy and grow as an individual.
That's amazing. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that. That brings up some excellent points. One is that, yes, sometimes the things that we've developed that work best for us when we're performing are not the way it, they don't help us in life. And part of my work would actually be to help people either find a different way. If it's working for them in performance, I don't want to touch it, you know?
Sure.
But if it's not working for them in their life, that's where we would kind of, I would call that bracing, where it's like, you don't need to brace when you're not playing. So how do we kind of unbrace and really regulate when we're not playing and then turn it back on when we need it so that it's not just a setting? That's one. Another is that sometimes what we've developed for performance, we think is best for us, but it's actually kind of, we've hit a plateau and we can go even higher. So that's also when I'm assessing someone. And that part doesn't usually come out in the first session, but as we work together, there's a delicate balance of, okay, can I actually get more out of your performance, or should we leave that part alone? So yeah, that part's interesting for me, as because it's also very interesting for me to really get to know someone and see what's really best for that person.
So as you're working with fighters, you know, like the physiological issues, like, so when I retired from the NFL, I was in Dr. Amon's study and on concussions and whatnot. And when they did all the scans, the part of my brain that was damaged was over here on the left frontal lobe. That just happens to be the part of the brain that deals with sympathy, empathy, and like emotion. And then when they went through, you know, the scans and then went through all their psychological testing, they're like, you know, you're very devoid of emotion. And when I left there, I was like, shit, I got brain damage. But it was cool. I had him write me a doctor's note that I sent to my mom and my girlfriend that was like, dude, I have a disability that allows me to be an insensitive asshole. But it was funny, as I talked to my older brother about it, he's like, you know, could it be the fact that that part of your brain is just underdeveloped because being too emotional didn't benefit you as an athlete? And I boxed from the time I was pretty young and did martial arts. And just like, you know, then, you know, obviously played a ton of sports and then figured out that I was, you know, boxing actually was more beneficial to playing football than it was to boxing. And then I got into playing football. But like that ability to kind of stand in the middle of the storm and like not ever, you know, really get rattled. Like I, you know, you stand in front of 100,000 people and I never heard the crowd. Like I never was like nervous by it. Like it never was felt overwhelming. Like when I stepped out there, I could have heard a pin drop. And people asked me one time, they're like, you know, when you retired, did you miss the roar of the crowd? And I'm like, I never heard it. Everything was just very, very silent. And then things moved in slow motion. And I felt like in that chaos, like that was the most, I guess you could say, like, not relaxing, but it was the simplest that life ever was, ever could be. And I really enjoyed it. And then one day I didn't get to do it anymore.
Yeah. And that story is not uncommon, even for myself. It's this flow state feeling where we developed it at such a young age that, like you said, towards the beginning of this, that we weren't pushed to find a different way. Not because people coddled us necessarily. There's many different aspects that go in and influences that go into our emotional landscape and our emotional development. But for a lot of athletes, that does happen. It's like, well, we developed our emotions in our sport. And so I think your brother might be onto something, that oftentimes it's not a damage thing. It's more of underdevelopment, and those pieces can be developed. And that's what's so amazing about the brain in general, that even if we didn't develop it until our 40s or 50s, it can still be developed. So you can teach an old dog new tricks.
So how do you teach old dogs? Like how do you develop that? Is it through, some form of like mental training? Is it through conversation? Like, how do you, like, I mean, it seems pretty interesting to say, how do you develop emotions that you've never necessarily had?
It's, you develop them the same way you did when you were a kid. And that's kind of with mental training, with, you know, with good conversations with people that care about you, all of the above. But first and foremost, you have to be your own. As an adult, there's a much greater component of you have to be your own teacher. You have to have, you now have some self-awareness and you have to practice that self-awareness and catch yourself. But that also includes, and this brings up a big point, a lot of self-compassion. Imagine that you are teaching the child, a child, but the child is you because you're new at it. And being new at a skill is like being a child. So messing up and being like, it's okay, and kind of walking yourself through it and not being like, you idiot, you did this and this again. You know, if that's not a preferable way to teach a kid. And so you should try to teach yourself in a way that you would teach a child.
I had my buddy Matt Vincent on the podcast recently, and he talked about, you know, he's kind of an interesting dude in that he was like a thrower, an athlete, and then got injured. And now he's kind of gone down this path where now he's kind of, my kids call him a shaman because he wears like, he takes people on these, I don't know, they do like plant-based medicine and travels, and he's kind of become this, I don't know, shaman is a good one. So we had a really dope conversation, but what he talked about is that what he observes the most is people's lack of love for themselves. And like he's like, if you could hear people's internal monologue, it's 1,000, if not infinite times worse than anything that they've ever heard in their life. Like he goes, people have, you know, are so critical and so hard and so like disgusted with themselves that if like we just got to see their internal monologue, he goes, you'd be pretty sad. And so like trying to teach, you know, like offer yourself grace and be able to offer yourself a little bit of self-love. I can totally agree with that, for the fact that, you know, in the hundreds of games that I played, I only remember the bad plays. And I was trying to explain this to my daughter. My daughter's 14 and she plays basketball, and her coach is way too emotional and yells at these kids. And the problem, and I told her this, I'm like, you know, boys are wired up a little bit different than girls. So girls are extremely hard on themselves too. But if for her, she only remembers the negative, and then she has a coach that only tells her the negative. So every time she leaves practice, every game, she feels like it was a complete failure. And yeah. I told her, I was like, Jamie, like, either I got to go choke this dude out, or I got to come have a come to Jesus moment with him, because all he's doing is he's reinforcing the negative. The entire world's going to be against you for your entire life. You don't need to have it start at 14. And I was like, you know, as an NFL player, like whether it be the media and fans and, you know, front office, like you're always battling all of these people that want to believe just the worst in you. And unfortunately, like you don't need that at this age. And my wife gave me a book on the difference in coaching boys and girls and men and women. And one of the ones was that like men and boys will succeed in spite. So if you tell me I'm not good enough, I'm going to train my ass to try to prove you wrong. Whereas if you have for women, they want to please and like, you know, like live up to somebody's expectation. And if that person's negative all the time, then it destroys their confidence. And so it's been really interesting because I grew up with all brothers. Obviously, I played in the NFL, so I've always worked around men. And now I have twin girls, and I have a little boy as well. So it's been really fascinating to realize, like, one, I'm totally not prepared for, like, as a girl dad. Like, I didn't, you know, I mean, the only girl we knew growing up was my mom. You know, there wasn't any girls on the street, but like, it's been pretty fascinating, like, going back and looking at this and then kind of observing it from the sidelines. And then viewing the parents who have no athletic background and have had no athletic success that are like viciously pushing their kids and like criticizing their kids. And so to the point where I told my wife, I'm like, I can't go to these practices. I can't go to these games. I'm just going to get pissed. And, you know, I'm not going to listen to unathletic, out of shape people chastise their kids about not playing hard at an age when these kids should be having fun, because there's a day where the shit isn't fun anymore and it becomes a full-time job. And you guys are making it a full-time job for 13, 14-year-old kids.
I think it's a big problem in sports. And I think it also harms the athletic development. Like if the kid is going to go far in sports, that kind of behavior leads to burnout early. I mean, not just in sports, but in life. Like a lot of overachievers started out as athletes getting like putting a lot of pressure on themselves and having a lot of pressure put on them. And they work hard. They they output a huge amount, but they think that this is the only way to work. And it leads to burnout, not just in sports, but just in their job, in their performance arena, whatever it is. And that's not a good way. And I agree, it's coming from a place of usually ignorance, where someone wasn't a high level athlete and somehow they think that this is how to get it done. Like in fencing, I see it all the time. They want to get their kid a scholarship to an Ivy League. It's like, yeah, fencing's not going to do that. There's no money in fencing. Just get your kid, you know, having fun in sports.
It had to be about 10 years ago. I went to an NFL event, and Troy Vincent was one of my teammates, was putting, was there, and he got up and gave a speech. And he said, you know, in the last 40, 50, I think it was 50 years at the time. He said in the last 50 years, about just under 45, 44,000 guys had played in the NFL. And it was less than 1,000 guys had played longer than 4 years. And I was sitting there, and there was a Leroy Glover, who I played against for a number of years, was in the room. And like, he looked at me and I looked at him, and then he started looking around, and he was like, and then they put the names up and they started going down, and we knew every name. And it was pretty interesting, because after, he's like, fuck, man, like most of the dudes in here didn't play longer than 3 years, or didn't play longer than 4 years. It's such a small percentage of people do this job for as long as we did. And so as I was trying to explain that to these parents, we're like, you know, there's a good chance that, and I've told this to other parents as well, like if, you know, you want your son to play in the NFL, is there an uncle or a cousin or somebody else played at a high level? Like, you know, I had one guy who's like, oh, I'd love for my son to play offensive line, and he wasn't that tall. And I'm like, you got like some 6'10" uncle hiding in the background. And he asked me, I'm like, yeah, I had an Uncle John who I'm named after, who, my dad told me stories. I guess it was my dad's uncle, that he used to chop wood, with, axes, one in each hand. And they would put wood up, and he was a big dude. He was like, my dad said he thought he was like 6'7", 6'8", but he was a big, strong dude. And he used to be able to literally just machine gun chopping wood, and they would put it out, and he would just literally cut wood two at a time with an axe in each hand. And so like, I was like, any stories like that? And they're like, no. And I'm like, there's a good chance that he's probably not going to get there, but you don't want to destroy somebody's, their dream. But like, where does, as a performance coach, being honest with somebody about like, the outcome, like if somebody comes to you and want to be a professional athlete, like I'm sure you can develop all this, but there has to be some intrinsic stuff. Whereas it's a lot easier to work with already high performing athletes who come in and you just need to kind of fine tune, you know, obviously help them be, you know, more confident and, you know, fix some of these issues in the past. Like, how does that piece work?
Well, I do have to be selective a little bit with it. In terms of my job is to get people performing at their best. Some people are not actually on board for that. And that's more, I will work with anyone who's highly competitive in whatever performance arena. I have a professional actor, you know, I have someone, a CEO, but the thing they have in common is that they're very driven. Whatever their issue is, they're very driven and they want to get to the top level. And I can work with them as long as that stays their goal. Where I have to draw the line is if someone really doesn't want to be competitive, or their issue, it's clear, it's a confidence issue or something, but they're never going to get to the point where they're competing at a high level. Whether or not no one's come to me say, make me pro. Mm. I can't do that. You know, I can't make you pro.
You sell more courses?
I can, if you are already, like you said, like, predisposed to being able to get to that level, I can get you to that level, but I can't make you have that drive and give you the things. I mean, I can help you with drive, but like you said, it's like there's so many factors that go into making someone actually a pro. And a lot of it is luck of the draw,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah, you are born into a family of giants, you know, or someone was born and they, into a family of people that never got taller than 5'5", they're probably not going to play professional basketball.
Well, I see this with our my Brazilian jiu-jitsu guys. I trained Victor Hugo and then Felipe Costa. I mean, they're from Brazil. At a young age, they had so much exposure to jiu-jitsu because it was just what they did. You know, they didn't grow up in, they kind of grew up in, you know, I'd not say extremely affluent areas, you know, kind of lower class where there wasn't a ton of opportunity. They're just, you know, I mean, these kids, like, all they did was jiu-jitsu, go to school, get out early, go and do jiu-jitsu. And that's all they did. And that's all Victor did. And that's all Philippe did. And now they're some of the best guys in their 20s. But like, as I try to explain to people, I'm like, you know, when there's not a lot of options and this is your option out, like, that's where they go hard. And I was like, you know, sometimes there's so many options in this, but I'm like, you know, fighter's the same one. If you look at, like, I always thought it was fascinating in boxing that if you look at who dominates boxing, it tends to be the people that are, you know, let's say, like, the most economically oppressed. So, I mean, in, like, I think it was like the early, you know, teens and 20s, there was a ton of great Jewish boxers. And then all of a sudden the Italians, and then you got into, you know, obviously the blacks, and then a lot of, like, the Latin and Mexican boxers and that, and you've kind of gotten into this thing now. I mean, there was a ton of Irish boxers at one point. I mean, even though in the UFC you got Conor McGregor, but it's kind of interesting, like, you know, turn of the century in the early 1800s, there was a ton of Irish boxers, and I've always been a fan of boxing. And I remember there was a place in Berkeley that we used to go to that had all these old pictures, and it was always fascinating to see some of the old boxers and how it all kind of fit together. But, you know, that kind of intrinsic, like, drive of, like, this is my way out, this is my path to success, where I'm going to save me and my family, like, to be able to shoulder that. I mean, I see it all the time in the NFL. And I remember at one point when I was going through, I was at the combine and we were going through interviews. I remember one of the guys said to me, he's like, man, you're a white middle-class kid from Southern California. You know, both your parents are married. You know, you just got a degree from Berkeley. You got a master's. Like, you don't really need this NFL stuff. Why do you want to go do it? And I thought that was kind of shitty for the fact that, like, you know, he's like, man, you're going up against kids that grew up in homeless shelters and their parents are crackheads and this whole thing. How are you going to compete with those guys? And I was like, first of all, fuck you. Second of all, the fact that I have to grow up in destitute in some poor deal so that I have the drive to come out and beat the shit out of guys. I mean, what about just the intrinsic motivation to go out and just want to, like, you know, beat people's ass every Sunday in front of millions of people? And then I realized that the people that I were talking to have the mental intelligence of, maybe 70, because those guys were not very sharp. And these were just them just being able to cast aspersions and fucking be terrible people. And that was very interesting to me. But even, you know, once you get into it, people are like, oh, you're pretty smart. Why are you doing this? And I'm like, why? I can't be intelligent and strategic about what I do. So there was definitely a lot of misconceptions I felt that were thrown on me as an NFL player.
I think that the topic of intrinsic motivation is a very important one. It's something that comes up a lot in my work, especially when it comes to discipline. And that's kind of what you're talking about, is like, you don't need to do this. You don't need to put in all this work, is essentially what they're saying, which is not, that's not right. You put work into things that you truly believe in. And sometimes it's amazing that you stayed so motivated. That's a gift. Even people that are driven are not always able to stay that.
I don't buy into motivation. I think motivation is very fleeting. I've seen people that are highly motivated, and, like, I think what it happens to be, one of the mantras and, like, kind of one of the taglines for Power Athlete for my company is, like, move the dirt. And where it came from was when I was a kid. I think I've told this story fucking probably too many times on the podcast, but this is your first time. So when I was a kid, we grew up in Southern California, but we had a heater, but my dad never hooked it up. which was kind of a cheap-ass move on his part. He's since passed.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real, tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
I talked shit to him, but we ended up burning, like during the winter, we would burn fires and we would burn wood. And so once a year or so, a huge cord of wood would get dropped in our driveway. And as we were coming home, we'd get off the bus, we would see this just massive pile of wood. And we knew that we had to stack it before dark because my dad liked to pull his car in the garage and he would come home late. And if he couldn't pull his car in, he'd be pissed. So we'd just come in, drop our bags, and we would just stack all this wood. And I remember my brother once said to me, he's like, hey, man, doesn't matter if you grab a big piece or a little piece. Just like, don't stop. As long as we don't stop, like, we're going to get this thing done. And so I went on a podcast. I think it was like the first podcast I ever went on. It was it's called Barbell Shrugged. And the guy asked me like what my idea of motivation and training and how I viewed it. And I said it, and I realized that probably a lot of people hadn't stacked wood like that. So I kind of changed it to like moving dirt. And I was like, you know, training's a lot like moving dirt. You know, there's a big pile. I got to move it from point A to point B. And some days I get a shovel, some days I get a spoon. But as long as I move a little bit of dirt every single day, I'm moving towards my goal. And that was like just basically off the cuff, me just trying to adapt what my brother had said. And I viewed training a lot like that, where it just came down to like, you know, this is the habit. This is what I do. This is who I am. I go train and I go play. And like the motivation wasn't like, I wasn't highly motivated to do it. It was just what I did. It was within my ethos. It was within my soul. It was who I knew myself to be. It was deep into my identity of how I viewed myself. And, I was a rhetoric major at Berkeley, and unfortunately, I read a lot of Stoic stuff and existential. And I had this vision of like, there's, the Marcus Aurelius, don't argue about what a good man is, just be a good man. Like a lot of that kind of black and white, which I think kind of screwed me in my NFL career a little bit because I didn't realize the dirtiness of the business. I just thought that people would be honorable. But for me personally, it was just more about like, this is who I am. This is my identity. And this is just what we fucking do. We just do the work. You sharpen the blades. So you get to go out on Sunday and literally cut people in half. And like, I was more motivated. And I know this is shitty. And I think about it now. I was more motivated out of a fear that somebody was going to be working harder than me. And I would meet that person and I wouldn't be able to match them, or I wouldn't be able to basically do what I wanted to do against that person who had worked harder than me.
I love that story, first of all. That it doesn't matter if you pick up a small piece or a big piece, and the whole outlook. When I use the word motivation, I don't mean in the fluffy sense. I mean it more how you mean it, that it's an internal drive, even though there are extrinsic components of it, like you're afraid that someone might be working harder than you. That drives you as much as your enjoyment of the actual sport itself. And that actually really ties in with my framework of how I work with people. And that's this idea. It's like you don't need to remember your why. Your why should be so ingrained that someone telling you remember why you're doing this almost sounds silly. Like, why would that help me on a bad day? Because I already know that's what I want. And so it's this idea that people don't have driven people don't have a motivation problem, but we are different people every day. And it's okay to not force it and instead work with you're feeling, this is where the self-compassion comes in. Finding ways to work with yourself so that you are choosing, like joyfully choosing what you need to do instead of working out of spite.
Yeah. So how do you explain that to athletes? I mean, just have to explain it to them. But if they've been kind of working in spite or working out of fear or place of fear, I don't recommend, especially for my young guys, like whenever I talk to people, and I've mentored a bunch of NFL guys that have come over the years, I'm like, what worked for me, I don't recommend to anybody. Because the problem is that it's very hard to find joy in what you do if you're literally working with the idea that like somebody is behind you, chasing you, and they're trying to come out and basically beat you, and you don't want to lose. And I would go out there, and like it wasn't necessarily like I'm going to go out and play my best and I'm going to really enjoy this. It was almost at the end of the game where I was like, thank God I caught that guy on his worst day. It was funny. My brother Ed, who's like my best friend in the world. It was funny. I'd always talk to him after the games. He'd go, how'd it go? I'm like, oh, I went pretty good. I think I caught that guy. He didn't have a good performance. I think I caught him on a bad day. My brother's like, how have you been catching motherfuckers on bad days for 10 years? He's like, you say this all the time. And I'm like, I just refuse to believe that this was his best performance and I was able to do what I wanted. And, you know, that fear of failure that I'm, you know, I mean, because you think about this in the NFL, and I don't know why this was so impactful to me, but the name on the back of the jersey, like there's nowhere to hide. That's not only my name. It's my dad's name, my brother's names, my kids' names. Like that name is not just my name. It's for everybody that's associated with me. And like the feeling of like not letting that name down and like realizing that like I have, it's more than just me. That it's all the people that have come before and behind and being able to go out and be able to, you know, do the job that a way that I feel proud of and honorable. And so, you know, since I've retired, where all of a sudden, you know, I take my kids, we went and saw the Chiefs play and ran into some former teammates and whatnot. And they came over and one of the guys was like, dude, your dad used to murder me. One of the guys is like, I'm pretty sure I have brain damage from your dad. So it was funny that the kids were like, cause I was married after I retired and had kids, for them to see that. And like, I remember my daughters were like, man, I didn't realize that like, you know, like those dudes had a lot of respect for you. I'm like, because I played the game the way that I should have. And you know, if you ever run into people, like they will always tell you, being like, oh, the guy was a good player. He was a hard player. And like, you know, he wasn't anybody I wanted to play more than once a year. And I think like that was a drive for me. Whereas, you know, I turn on TV and I see guys up there talking and I'm like, that guy fucking sucked. You know, seeing, you know, Damon Woody up there and I'm like, that guy was fucking awful. Or, you know, Booger McFarland and some of these other guys that I watch. And I'm just like, these guys were fucking dog shit. I would be mortified if somebody was seeing me up here or listening to this podcast and being like, fuck that Wellborn guy. That guy sucked. Like, and I know that shouldn't matter, but in some weird way it does. You know, I mean, like I think as a professional athlete, like there's a certain level of reverence and respect. I remember I was probably 10 years old. And if you're a boxing fan, you'll remember, when, Hagler fought Hearns, you know, it was like 1986. I think I was 10. And, I remember watching those two guys come out, you know, in little trunks, just like carved out of stone and standing in the middle and throwing bombs and realizing like, I never want to kick anybody again. Martial arts is stupid. I want to box. And like that, like, you know, and you still hear people talk about those fights and like, you know, the way, you know, like the reverence of boxing and professional sports. And I think like that to me is what you wanted. And then on the other side of that, you have guys like Ryan Leaf, you know, where like as soon as the NFL draft, which is coming up, they'll talk about the biggest bust in history. And that dude is always number one. And like they talk about his drug problem and this, I mean, everything. And they shit on that dude. Like, I'm just like, fuck, like. To be the number one guy that they talk about as the worst pick, the biggest bust in NFL history, and that never goes away. Like, I don't like that's something I would never want to shoulder. Like, that's the motivation.
You bring up a very important point when it comes to finding joy. It's like understanding that the pressure is a fact. You don't have to put all of your feeling into that pressure, because the pressure is a fact. Just like it's a fact you want to win. You don't have to think about the outcome. You know it in your heart. You know it. Good athletes know in their heart they want to win. They don't have to spend time thinking about whether they're going to win or lose, because it's in their heart. And sometimes they're still hung up on it, and we can quickly shift that mindset away from that. But it works the same with pressure. If you want to find joy, see that the pressure is a fact. Accept it, and then choose to work towards a different outlook. Choose to start that task with joy. So there's a lot of existentialism in the work that I do. And it's not as simple like, okay, sometimes it is that simple. I'm going to choose to be excited about this. But oftentimes there's a hang up there where the pressure seems too great, or there's obstacles. And in my framework, especially if you take my course, we deal a lot with like analyzing. It's a problem solving approach to all of this, where you analyze what is the actual hang up, and then you apply a tool to that hang up so that you can start your goal, whatever it is, like with that full pride and joy that that you might want to have.
I had an interesting conversation with my daughter about she's a pretty good athlete, but and she's a decent basketball player. You know, I mean, she's like 14, right? She's in eighth grade. And so I asked her, I was like, you know, she likes watching basketball. And we were watching like North Carolina women. And I asked her, like, is this something you would want to do? Because I took her to a basketball like skills camp, and they kind of evaluated them. And I'm sitting in the room with all these parents, and like the guy who's run the camp is like, you know, you have to decide at a young age if you want them to be able to just, you know, go out and have a great experience, or if you want them to try to play college basketball, which I thought was hilarious. I'm like, can't they have a great experience and do both? But I asked my daughter, because I realized for me, I was pretty skinny when I started, and you're gonna laugh at this. I was like 6 foot, 165 pounds. And then I started lifting weights, and then I left high. By the time I was a senior, I was like 6'4", 250. And then I grew 2 more inches in college, and I was like 6'6", like, 310 pounds. So from the time I was 14 to like 22, I probably put on, I mean, I doubled in size. You know, I grew from more, I grew 6 inches and put on, you know, double in body weight. And so as I was talking to my daughter, it's like, you know, is this something that you want to maybe play in college? Do you want to be competitive? And she's like, I want to be great. And I was like, oh, fuck, I never really thought about that. That was a great point. She's like, but I don't really want to work hard. I just want to find something that I'm just naturally great at, that I don't have to put any effort forth. And I was like my head popped off, and I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So what you're saying is you want to be great, but you're not willing to do whatever it takes to be great? And I was like, you know, because like your biggest come up, like I was joking with her, I'm like, your biggest glow up as an athlete isn't necessarily going to happen within the skills of basketball. It's going to happen within the training. You're going to learn to jump. You're going to learn to run, like all of the sharpening of the blade of like GPP and athleticism. Like that's where you're going to make like your massive gains. Like you can go out and do skills 6 days a week, and that's fine. But like the amount of distance that you'll cover in 1 to 2 years, just starting to lift weights and actually performance training, thank God your dad and his friends know something about this, is going to be monumental, especially at the age, especially if you adopt it in this. And she's like, yeah, I just don't know if I want to work that hard. But I was like, but I thought you wanted to be great. And she's like, I do. So then I realized, I was like, you know what? This has to be like the 14-year-old girl brain, because in my mind, I never in a million years thought about being great. Like greatness was never something. I just wanted to prove people wrong that said I couldn't do it. Like, so I, you know, people, oh, you're not strong enough, or you're never going to do this, or you're not good. I just had like a list of those people in my mind that I was going to prove fucking wrong. And like greatness wasn't necessarily even like in the equation. It was just more physical. It was more about like developing myself and just fucking proving people that they're pieces of shit and I was going to be better than them. That was it. And like, you know, like, you know, from a basketball coach, it was like, you suck at basketball. Like I had a basketball coach in like eighth grade who was a drunk, and he used to kick the balls at us and tell us we were terrible and never play. And then he's like, when you go to high school next year, you're going to quit football in 1 year. And I was like, and then I remember I got a scholarship. I was a senior in high school, and my brother and I were out at the track training. We saw the dude. And I was like, oh, that's that motherfucker I had in eighth grade. And we chased him to his car, and he locked himself in his car and drove away. We were going to beat his ass. But like things like that, where like, you know, that's the difference in motivation, where like, you know, like, don't believe in me, and I'm going to prove you fucking wrong. And it was really just fascinating to me that she was like, you know, I want to be great. And she asked me, did you ever think about being great? I'm like, never once. And, it's been a really interesting learning moment having kids and especially having girls and like listening to these and asking them these questions. And I'm sure they're super fucking annoyed at me always asking them these questions. Like they're just always like, oh.
It's interesting because this is where what I said in the beginning, that there are so many paths to greatness and so many different motivations. Is it wrong to want to be great? No. Is it wrong to want to prove people wrong? No. There are many paths. People have their own motivations for doing things. Yeah, the 14-year-old, like, I don't want to work hard. Sometimes that's a 14-year-old thing to say in general. But it can click at different times. And that's kind of part of the work. It's like sussing out, is this a developmental... I prefer to work with adults for that reason, but I'll work with like older teens as well, because sometimes there's so many different developmental, I don't even know, attitude shifts that happen. For me, I was a walk-on in the NCAA, and I had a very strange style. I was one of those people that wasn't very good in practice, and my teammates, I was a freshman, and they were like, why is this girl here? And then our first preseason home meet, I destroyed the entire UPenn crosstown rival like team, and that UPenn had a good fencing team, and they were eliminating my teammates, and I eliminated their entire squad except for the junior world champion, and I came in second place, and my teammates never ever questioned my abilities again. But it was, I had the intrinsic motivation, but I didn't understand how to work hard to build skills yet. That didn't click in until partway into my NCAA career. So people can, it will click for the people that really want to do it. It will click. It might click for your daughter if she wants to be great. It might click just naturally when she's given the tools on how to work hard. That makes sense for her, because even those are individualized. Yeah. The way one person works hard is going to be different from the way another person approaches training completely.
What can like young athletes do to combat coaches? Because I feel like a lot of the coaches saddle these kids with their own failures or their own shortcomings. And that was something I observed as over the number of years that, you know, you got a shitty high school coach who's, you know, mad at the world. He's a high school football coach and, you know, takes it out on the kids. And so, you know, like, and that's something that I've, you know, helping my kids navigate this where like, you know, the negativity or, you know, cause there's two types of coaching. I mean, I don't think I was ever told that I did something well. Fucking, I mean, I don't even know if I got told that in the NFL. Like, I mean, they just always focused on the negative so well. And I remember I think I was in my second or third year in the NFL. And then we were in there watching tape during training camp. And like my coach put on some stuff and he was showing, and I was sitting in there and he was showing it to the young guys. And he's like, hey, I want you guys to watch the way John does this. And he goes, and then he stopped it and he goes, okay, this next part I don't want you to do. You know, John is, you know, really athletic and does a lot of things really well that unfortunately you guys can't do. And so I want you to look at this one piece, but like, don't worry about the other part. So I had the ability to set and then like use my head like a third hand where I could shoot my hands in my head. And when most people do it, they actually extend their hips, which when they stop and they stop their feet and they lunge. I had the ability to do it from a crouch position where I could take almost like short jabs like a boxer and use my head and my hands as like a weapon and not and continue to move my feet. So I used it to redirect people and it was pretty vicious. And just,
did it feel weird that he was complimenting you by showing your,
yeah. Yeah, it was the first time I think anybody ever paid me a compliment, and it wasn't actually like, hey, you did this. I just happened to be in the room when he was complimenting me to the young guys.
Wow.
And I remember thinking like, fuck, I think that's the first time anybody's ever told me I did a good job or I had like a unique skill. And I was like, fuck, like it was extremely weird. And I was like, oh, I guess I am okay at this job. you know, and I came in and started as a rookie.
Kind
and,
of like,
yeah.
Oh, go
oh,
for
no,
it.
No, I mean, I came in and started as a rookie and I had been a starter. And I assume, you know, you're a starter in the NFL, you're probably pretty good, but I don't ever remember anybody ever being like, hey, you're pretty fucking good at this.
When you were in that moment where you mentioned that it was like a realization that you were pretty good, when you saw that your coach was showing the other guys how great you were, what was there anything else going through your mind that about how it felt to be see yourself like that or him showing people?
No, I just remember thinking, you know, everybody like, so this is a fascinating deal and same thing in boxing. I'm sure it's in fencing. Everybody like, everybody has a certain skill set that separates them from everybody. Like, you know, like very few people. It's why I'm sure you went in and let's say you were fencing and somebody said, oh, you remind me of so-and-so, right? Like, oh, they had a similar setup or they do this. So the same thing in football. This still happens to this day where people be like, oh, this guy reminds me of this guy. He has a skill set. So everybody has a unique skill set that allows them to be what they're able to do. And I played, like I mentioned Will Shields. Will Shields did some things on the field that like, if I had done, I would have got cut. And I remember watching him do it and be like, fuck, how did he do that? And like, he had this weird move where he kind of drop his arm, give his guy his shoulder, then move his feet. And I'd be like, fuck, dude, I would have got beat a million times doing that. And so when you get to that level, everybody has such a unique skill set. I just kind of couched it as like, oh, this is my wheelhouse. This is what I do. And unfortunately, much like me observing other people, there were skills that other people had that I didn't have, that he was showing my wheelhouse. And it wasn't necessarily that like, you know, this guy's incredible. He can do all these things. Like, this is what he does really well. And if you can take something from it, but I don't want you guys to do it because none of you are athletic enough to do this. So it was kind of like an interesting thing where I didn't necessarily be like, oh, I guess I'm pretty good. I just was like, oh, that's my wheelhouse. That's who I am. And I remember I ran into Michael Strahan in a bar in New York. This was, you know, during my NFL career. We'd go up on Monday nights, go to New York when I was in Philly. And I ran into Stray and he was sitting there and he's like, man, when we watch, like when we go over like the scouting reports to play you guys, they always circle your name. And he gave me the scouting report on me. And it was like, this guy is like, you know, plays with good pads, you know, fast hands, you know, extremely violent, like just kind of like gave me a lot of this nice stuff. And I was like, oh, so I always, the compliments that I ever got were always kind of third party. Like, I made John Madden's horse trailer was a kind of a neat one. And Madden came down and was very complimentary. So it was always kind of like an indirect way, more so than like a coach being like, hey, you're pretty good. Like there was never, and I don't know, maybe it's just different, but I just don't ever remember coaches being like, you're really good at this. You're a great player. Like, I want to see you be the best version of yourself. How can I help you be that best version? And all the guys that I've worked with, I say that to them. I'm like, you know, here's your skills. How do I help you be the best version of you? Like, I want you to be the best. I want you to have a great career. I want you to play at a high level. Like, what do we need to do to make that happen? And I think it was because I never got that piece.
It's great that you do that for your students because that brings up the fact that you had to wait until you heard it third party to see what your wheelhouse is. This is why it's so important for coaches to give constructive and positive feedback because it helps shape not only the, you know, the confidence of the athletes, but helps them actually develop to be their best self. Giving compliments is a good thing when it's it's not like handing out participation trophies. There's real reasons, motivation, confidence, focus, discipline. If you know what your skills are, if you know what your strengths are, and this goes back to even my assessment, I always ask athletes what they feel their strength is as an athlete. Because they've come to me because they have a concern, but I want to know what they feel their strengths are so that we can really begin to work on changing their mindset away from maybe focusing on everything that's going wrong and really build from a place of strength and build up that joy. So I would say to your question about what you do about bad coaches is it's hard. I mean, ideally you find a better coach
yeah.
for your kid. But that's not always, oftentimes that's not an option. And I think talking to your kids about, you know, being realistic with them, like, this coach has a problem. It's not you. And let's see if we can find what your strengths are. And see if they can find a role model that isn't their coach. Either it doesn't even have to be someone that they know. It can be a player a professional player that they see some of themselves in. It can be someone on their team, like an upperclassman, that they find really traits that they want to emulate, not just moves.
So when I was a young guy in the NFL, they were showing me tape all the time. And I remember I finally asked the coach, I was like, hey, do you have any like 6'5" white dudes? Because you're just showing me like 6'7", 6'8" black guys. Like, do you have anybody that looks like me who's doing this job in a way that like is good? And like when I said that, the coach like looked at me and was like, huh, I never thought of that. And he's like, yeah, let me find you some stuff. And then he found me guys like Jumbo Elliott and Jim Lachey, and like found all these guys that were, you know, Gary Zimmerman, dudes that were about my size and like, you know, like looked like me. And then I was like, oh, okay, here's how these guys were solving this problem. All right, this is beneficial because, you know, like a 6'8" black dude who's 350 pounds is going to play a very, very different game than me. And so that was really beneficial. So something actually I said this to my daughter recently. I was like, you need to find somebody who kind of looks like you and is about your size, and you need to look at their game and try to model your game after them. It's the fastest way you can do to improve. That way, like if somebody's already figured this thing out, like use them as a lighthouse. And I was like, you know, Kelsey Plum, I think that's her name, Kelsey Plum. Yeah. I was like, she's about your size. She's a brunette. She's incredibly athletic and is a dominant player. Like, look at what her game is. And like, let's model it after her. And so we pulled up some tape and watched, and she's like, oh, Dad, she's so good with the ball. She's so, I'm like, Jade, like all that athleticism is inside of you. You just have to train it out. Like basketball, you can only develop so much basketball skill. Like all of the physical capabilities that you develop, all that stuff that happens in the weight room, that's going to be your biggest jump. And that was, you know, pretty interesting. But I think, and then when we went to that skills camp, the coach said the exact same thing. You guys need to find somebody that like, you know, looks like your daughter, that like allows her to kind of emulate it. And what was funny was like, nobody ever said that to me. And it was actually my own thing where I was like, I don't know what the fuck you want me to do because these dudes don't look like me. And I think like that was, so when you brought that up, I was like, man, that is such a smart thing. Like I had Will Fries, who plays for the Vikings, came and trained with me in his contract year. And he ended up listening to the podcast and ended up, you know, watching tape and was like, oh man, I like the way you play. Can you come work with me? And he showed up and the kid was incredible. The amount of like quality of movement and what he was able to do. And just, it was like, man, like in just giving him a little bit of skill and just being like, hey, like, this is what I think you do well. I think you need to lean on this. And he was like, man, I don't think anybody's ever looked at it like that for me. And I'm like, yeah, because I think a lot of coaches are looking at coaching the whole. I'm looking at like coaching the individual. The way I always viewed, you know, team sports is that if everybody maximizes their individual potential to the point where it pulls the whole group up, and then, you know, you work in unison. And I was like, you're, you know, the best way you can help your team is by being the best version of yourself. And,
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's been an interesting one, but yeah, it's definitely, you know, and then, like I said, you know, training the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys has been really a lot of fun because they have, and I don't mean this in a weird way, but like I joke that they have this immigrant mentality where, you know, they come to America and they come here for jiu-jitsu to be professional jiu-jitsu players. And this is why they're in this country. So there's no, you know, they're not here to party or have a good time or, you know, they're here to do jiu-jitsu and to be the best in the world. And this is their opportunity for greatness. And I tell them all the time, I'm like, you know what, like all you have to do is just like answer the call. You guys are here for a reason. You already have all these physical gifts. You just have to like move the dirt, do the work. And then when you show up on game day, you have to be ready. The conditioning has to be on point, and you have to just be able to embrace it and be willing to, you know, like allow yourself to be great. That's another thing I noticed about a lot of athletes. Like there's this feeling of like greatness is out there, but like, can I allow myself to be great? Because there's a lot of like insecurity inside. And that's something I realized towards the end that like, oh, it's okay to be great. Like, I can seize this. Like, I have to almost give myself permission.
Yeah, definitely. There's this, and that goes back to the finding joy. It's not just whether you know you can do something. It also goes back to like fully believing in yourself. That self-compassion really makes a difference, because it's hard to actually believe in yourself if you are constantly dogging on yourself. And practicing that self-compassion aspect, it's not, I always tell people, because when I mention self-compassion to fighters, they're like, you mean like going easy on myself? It's like, no. I mean, sometimes if you're injured and you actually need to rest, that is self-compassion. But it's about like supporting yourself as best as, being your best mentor and best coach. And what would your best mentor say to you? They wouldn't dog on you before you go out there. They'd be like, I believe in you. You're going to be great.
So, all right. What about failure, right? I know failure is a part of life. And, you know, you talk to athletes. I mean, everybody's failed more times than they can count. I'm sure you failed as well, you know, wins and losses.
Absolutely.
How important is, I mean, you know, like I remember reading a book that said, you know, you need to fail more, and that, you know, when you fail in the face of adversity and just keep getting back up, you can do it. But like, not everybody deals with failure the same way. Like, how do you kind of get somebody to kind of move past that and not spiral down and be like, oh, you know, pity party, I'm never going to be able to do this, I've failed too many times. Like, how do you create that resilience?
Well, you can agree failure is critical. It's, champions fail more than they win. We just don't see all their failures. And I'd say the thing that makes the difference is being able to move that loss and from the past and make it actionable for the future. That's the biggest difference between people who spiral and people who grow. If you are looking at your loss in the past, like, I should have done this, I should have done that, and you can't take it out of the past, that's when you're going to spiral there. If you can reflect on the past, take out all the necessary components and make it actionable for the future, like, okay, I'm going to extend my arm more on this next one. That's what I learned from that past one. I'm going to extend my arm more on this next one. And then I have the ability to do that because I'm fast as lightning. Adding that little motivator in there too is also something that will really boost resilience.
Okay. What about burnout? Right. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, failure is a part of everything, but like, how do you balance burnout? Because for a lot of athletes, they just kind of assume that high performance, the result of high performance is burnout. How do you balance that and like tell them that like burnout isn't a normal part of everything? And I, you know, we see this with the fighters all too often. They get through a training camp, they get to the big fight and they, you know, win or lose and they get a ton of burnout. How do you balance that? Like, you know, and realize that it's just not a part of success.
I see this a lot in people that grew up as athletes and now they're in their professional capacity and they believe that, you know, pushing towards a deadline is the way you live your life. And that is really detrimental physically and mentally. That's what burnout is. It's you stop being able to output. Everything is a balance. If you find that you're constantly pushing for deadlines, whether it's in sports or, you know, like you're constantly giving max effort doesn't necessarily mean pushing to your limits. It also means encompassing recovery. It means self-care, eating food that is nutritious, getting enough sleep. These are all included in the package of longevity and I mean performance longevity. Like, you can perform at your very best short term with that burnout mentality, but long term, there are repercussions. So learning to really incorporate self-care and the necessary rehabilitation that comes with a balanced work life is really what's going to keep you succeeding long term.
So there's a lot of bullshit in the mindset space. I mean, like, just as I was prepping for this podcast, watching your stuff and then just kind of clicking on some of the hashtags and going through it, there are so many of these, like, just, I guess you could say, like, cryptic fake coaches that are pushing this advice that just sounds good, but it just doesn't really have a ton of substance. Oddly enough, one of the guys that I've worked with for a number of years has kind of morphed into this. This is his next path. So, like, what are these coaches peddling that you think is complete nonsense, and what's good in this mindset space? Because it's so unquantifiable. Not that I'm casting stones at it, but like saying to somebody, I'm going to make you perform better. Like, what does that look like? And more importantly, like, it's kind of like almost like, I'm not going to shit on chiropractors, but like, oh, I can make you feel better if I get you an adjustment. But like when in that mindset space, there just feels like there's a lot of charlatans. How do you combat that? And more importantly, like, what are they peddling that you just sit back and you're like, fuck, this is awful.
I haven't personally seen too much. Well, that's not true. That's not true. I've seen some nonsense out there. I think this, the no excuses mentality long-term leads to burnout. While short-term no excuses is like a band-aid. It's something, it's a tool. It's a tool rather than an actual framework. So what I mean is people that say, oh, do this exact routine and nothing else and you will get to success. So this kind of like this rigid mindset where you do it this way. We've even discussed in this session why the rigidity doesn't work. Like, each person is an individual and each day is a different day. So this idea that there's only one way to get to success is something you should be very wary of. Also, the no excuses mindset, while it's that in and of itself is a tool, that as a platform, again, leads to this rigidity. It's like there are things that aren't excuses that actually can, you know, that do crop up. So anyone peddling a one-way ticket to success is peddling bullshit.
Okay.
The other thing I would be wary of is if they're only explaining why, but not how. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So for your courses, if I was to log on and, you know, we'll post a link in the show notes if people want to check out the courses, like, kind of give me a little bit of like an understanding of like what I'm going to get. And if somebody's excited about it, like, you know, they click through and jump in, like, what's available to me and, you know, how can I help ramp up my performance through these courses?
So I work one-on-one with individuals. We do one-on-one sessions. That's one way to work with me. But the other is I have a course. It's a discipline enhancement course, but it's often for people that already are pretty driven. And I would say people that tend to be these overachievers, burnout happens, and then they no longer want to do their goal. So within the course, there's goal setting, there's my framework for discipline, and then tools and techniques for any kind of situation that they would find themselves in, emotionally, physically, people with hectic lives that are very driven, but they have three kids and are really intensely passionate about their job or not. But it's for people that really need a structure that isn't rigid. So it's very flexible. It's all based in evidence-based research in sports psychology. This is something else when you're looking for a performance coach, look for people with the background, with the knowledge, that it's not just coming from a place of liking to talk. And so, yeah, if you get my course, you get the toolbox, you get a ton of my techniques and tools and the whole framework of how to find joy and pride in yourself and kind of keep that determination going with your goals so you don't feel like you're just dragging yourself through it.
Awesome. Well, that's all I got. Any questions for me?
I mean, I have a ton of questions for you. I don't think that we have time for it. But
I'll take one. If you got any questions for me, as I'm sitting here, I'm like, man, I'd love to. I don't think I've ever asked anybody if they had any questions for me, but I figured maybe you did or have one or two.
I am so curious about what, and this might not be something you would want to answer, but you mentioned that you had a coach that was peddling bullshit for a while and you didn't know. I'd be so curious to know how you found out, what you felt was bullshit about it.
You hit it on the head where I feel that this is kind of a place where if you can't establish yourself as maybe a strength conditioning coach or you're having a success, I'm going to work on the mindset stuff. And it's very easy to kind of sit back and read a bunch of self-help books and see what others are doing and then kind of like create your method. And like you made a great point where, you know, like, background in psychology and like doing a lot of these, like there has to be a practical amount of training. Like I said, I was a rhetoric major in college and went on and got my master's in education. And like that classical training and that classical background has been extremely impactful for what I do, not only with the podcast, but coaching athletes. I mean, everything from like understanding ethos, pathos, and logos and going through and discussing this with people. And I was very fortunate when I retired from the NFL, I got hired to work for CrossFit. And I worked for CrossFit and I taught hundreds of seminars around the globe and had to get up and present and create a method. And a lot of what I did as a rhetoric major was so impactful to getting up and just being able to command a room, being able to convey information and really just like expressing myself and being able to convey what I wanted people to learn. And I think a lot of times in this space, especially for like mindset, there's people that kind of subscribe to this, like, you know, what I call the Navy SEAL mindset, where it's the David Goggins or the Jocko, where you got to wake up at 4:35 and, or you got to, you know, run hundreds of miles and, you know, don't be a pussy. And, this is weakness in here. And then you have on the other side, this kind of foo-foo, you know, let's talk about your emotions and help. And it's just like, it's all over the spectrum. It's kind of like performance training where you're looking at everything from balancing on a busu ball to Pilates to lifting heavy weights. Like everything can be couched in that way. And a lot of times when I hear people talk, it sounds like bullshit. And I'm like, how are you helping these individuals? Oh, and it's always this kind of beyond the screen, this kind of black box. And I think what you're talking about is getting in and like understanding somebody's motivations, understanding their fear and helping them create, you know, tools to help them manage these in their biggest moments. Because, if somebody doubts themselves or they don't have the confidence and whatnot, like, but unfortunately, the only way you know that is if you've been in that situation yourself and you've taken others on that journey. And so I always go back to like whenever people pitch me or I hear this, I'm like, well, who have you worked with? Who have you helped? Is this just something you hatched in your garage and decided to come up with a cool name and, you know, this method? Or you went to a weekend seminar somebody else put on and now you just kind of want to do a version of what they're doing? Like it just sounds like bullshit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how I view it.
Well, thank you for that.
Well,
yeah, I was so curious.
Yeah, well, we'll end it there, but we'll post up your stuff in the show notes. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And it was great to connect with you. And I'm sure I'll reach out. And at some point, maybe we'll figure out a way to work a little bit more together.
Sounds great. Oh, one last thing. I realize if you're listening to this podcast, I have a special coupon for you if you would like to take my course.
Lay it on us.
It's and the coupon, if you type Power Ath, like this, the name of this podcast, but shortened, you will get $60 off if you'd like to find my discipline framework for joy in your goals.
Yeah, we'll post that, the link, and we'll post that code in the show notes. And when we push it out, we'll talk about it. So I'm excited. So thanks for coming on Power Athlete Radio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Awesome. See ya. This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market.
We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.